Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is June the 1st, 2023. Last year, I did a great show with a very distinguished historian, Matthew Delmont, on what we called the simultaneously heroic and shameful story of African-American soldiers in World War II. He has an important new book out. He's a historian, half American, the epic story of African-Americans fighting World War II at home and abroad. And today we're pursuing a somewhat similar theme, but only the story of Black American soldiers and one particularly distinguished African-American, W.E.B. Du Bois, in the First World War. As it happens, this book just came out last month, and the book was very well reviewed in the New York Times by Matthew Delmont. I'm thrilled that Chad Williams, the author of Wounded World, is with us. Chad, congratulations on the new book.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
I mean, I think it's rather facile to compare the experience of World War One and World War Two for African Americans in terms of what was more shameful, what was more discriminatory and more unjust. But how does World War One, the experience of African American soldiers in World War One, compare to the experience of African American soldiers in World War Two?
Yeah, I think there are important similarities as well as differences as well. And it's really important to understand the history of the Black experience in World War I and the particular history and experience of African-American soldiers in order to fully appreciate their experiences during World War II. Many of the same challenges that Black soldiers faced in World War II that Matt Delmont writes about so eloquently in his recent book were experienced by African-American soldiers in World War I in terms of Jim Crow discrimination, racial violence, disconnect between fighting for democracy abroad and not experiencing and receiving a democracy at home. Many of those similarities existed between the two world wars, but there are important differences as well.
380,000 African Americans served in the American Army during World War I, according to the National Archives. How does that compare to the Second World War?
The number of African American troops in World War II was significantly higher. World War II was obviously a much bigger war in terms of the American war effort, the size and scale of the American military experience, but the numbers of Black troops who served in World War I at the time was incredibly significant. It was the highest number of Black troops that had ever served in the American Army up to that point. Prior to World War I, there were roughly 200,000 African Americans who served in the Union Army during the Civil War. So the number of African American troops who served in World War I was actually quite significant. And I think it's something that many Americans, even today, do not fully appreciate, are not aware of the significant contributions that African Americans made to the American war effort in World War I and the specific experiences of African American troops. That was something that W.E.B. Du Bois was very much invested in learning about.
The Delmont book is a straight history of African Americans in the war. Your book is a kind of book about a book, or a book about an imaginary book. Your book, The Wounded World, W.E.B. Du Bois in the First World War, is a book about a book that W.E.B. Du Bois intended to write about the African American experience in World War I. Tell me a little bit more about that. I have to admit, I wasn't familiar with this story. It's a remarkable story.
It really is remarkable. I was doing research for what would become my first book, Torchbearers of Democracy, and came across an unfinished and unpublished manuscript by W.E.B. Du Bois on the Black experience in World War I that he titled The Black Man and the Wounded World. He worked on this project for nearly two decades. It would have been one of his most significant works of history and arguably the definitive history of the Black experience in the war. And he never finished it. And very few historians know anything about this remarkable project and Du Bois's long investment in writing about, but also reckoning with the history and legacy of World War I. That's the story that I tell in my book.
W.E.B. Du Bois is arguably the greatest African-American intellectual in history, as well as one of the greatest American intellectuals in history, perhaps the greatest. Most people would be familiar with his work, The Souls of Black Folk from 1903. Give us an outline of Du Bois's history in the first 15 or 20 years of the 20th century, after The Souls of Black Folks came out.
Sure. And Du Bois is such a remarkable individual. He lived an incredible life, 95 years from 1868, born just a few years after the end of the Civil War, dies in Ghana in 1963, literally on the eve of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Such a long, complex life. And it's important to understand him at different moments, at different times in his life. Du Bois, after he publishes The Souls of Black Folk, is arguably one of the leading voices of African-Americans and other peoples of African descent, certainly at the dawn of the 20th century. He had an incredible pedigree, the first African-American to receive a PhD from Harvard University. He had published works in history and sociology. So by the time he publishes The Souls of Black Folk and in the years leading up to World War I, he's widely recognized as not only the preeminent Black intellectual in the country, but one of the most significant leaders of Black people in the United States and really throughout the entire African diaspora.
He's often compared and contrasted with Booker T. Washington. Is that a fair comparison? Is that helpful both to make sense of Booker T. and Du Bois, and also make sense of some of the intellectual arguments and discussions within the African-American community at the beginning of the 20th century?
Certainly. The debate, the rivalry, if you want to characterize it that way, between W.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington was one of the defining moments of the Black experience in the early 20th century. This larger question of what was the best course of action for African-Americans to take in fighting for their citizenship, their basic human rights in the United States. This larger issue of the color line, something that Du Bois was deeply invested in. He believed, unlike Booker T. Washington, that it was essential for African-Americans to assert their civic and racial equality, to fight for higher education, and to not compromise in the face of white supremacy and attacks on African-American humanity. This was a larger debate about who was best suited to speak on the behalf of Black people and to represent Black people in the early 20th century.
Some of the criticisms of Booker T. is that it was a kind of tacit acknowledgement of a parallel world, perhaps an inferior world for Black Americans, whereas Du Bois was aggressively integrationist, suggesting that whatever whites could do, Blacks could do as well, if not better. Mm. How did this play out in terms of the war? Were the Booker T. crowd, were they less interested or perhaps indifferent to African-Americans serving in the war as Du Bois, who is controversially associated with being in favor of the war?
Certainly. Well, it's important to remember that Booker T. Washington passes away in 1915. So by the time the United States enters the war, W.B. Du Bois is arguably the unquestioned voice of the race. And most African-Americans, particularly most educated African-Americans, were following his lead and recognizing that his voice carried tremendous weight. So when the United States enters the war and Du Bois makes the very difficult decision to support the United States, to support the Allied effort, he's speaking for a larger constituency of African Americans that have his support. Many of those individuals were also associated at one time or another with the Tuskegee Institute and Booker T. Washington. So most African Americans, particularly those of the so-called talented 10th, as Du Bois described him, thought the way that he did, that African Americans needed to support their country. They needed to do their duty in fighting for their country and hopefully in the end, expanding the boundaries of democracy in the United States and gaining increased citizenship rights at the end of the war.
Chad, you talked about Du Bois's quote unquote voice. Of course, no Americans knew the voices of their politicians or leaders or thinkers unless they experienced them in person. Mm-hmm. The most distinguished and successful Americans tended to be great speakers like William Jennings Bryan. How did Du Bois communicate with America, particularly Black America, but also White America? Was he a good speaker? Did he have a great voice like Bryan?
Du Bois didn't have the best speaking voice. He couldn't rile up a crowd, you know, the way that a William Jennings Bryan or Teddy Roosevelt could, or even a Booker T. Washington, for that matter. Du Bois was an intellectual. He was very professorial in many ways in terms of his public oratory. He was best suited to communicate with African Americans through the written word, and especially through The Crisis, which he edited for the NAACP. His editorials really served as the way for him to express his views, his opinions on pretty much every major issue that Black people were facing in the country, as well as throughout the world during the time that he was editor of The Crisis. So even though he spoke extensively throughout the country, he was not necessarily known for being the most rousing public speaker.
In an odd way, perhaps his professorial air was similar to Woodrow Wilson, the president. We've done a number of shows, Chad, on the America of this time and the enormous complexity and passion of whether America should enter the war. Did a show with Neil Langtott on Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Jane Addams and the progressivism that dragged or didn't drag America into war. Another with Mark Arsenault about the imposters' war, propaganda and press. Tell us about why Du Bois was in favor of the war, because had one not known the story, I think a lot of people would simply have guessed that he wouldn't have supported the war, perhaps seeing it in many ways as a white man's war, a colonial war, a war fought many thousands of miles away over territory, which has nothing to do with African Americans.
Yeah, Du Bois has a very complex relationship to the war. As I tell in my book, he considered himself a pacifist. He was, at least in theory, opposed to war. But he also recognized that the war was a potentially unique opportunity for African Americans and other peoples of African descent to change the course of the 20th century as it related to the future of democracy. He identified the roots of the war very prophetically in the imperial and colonial competition for Africa, its human and material resources amongst the different European powers. But he also recognized that the war was an opportunity, a rare moment to actually destabilize the future of empire and to lay the groundwork for eventual self-determination and democratic rights for peoples of African descent. So just as African Americans had fought in every American war prior to World War I, just as they had served valiantly on the battlefield in the Civil War, for example, in fighting for their freedom and eventual citizenship, Du Bois believed that World War One, the Great War, as it was called at the time, would be a similar moment, but on an even grander scale, to bring democracy to Black people in the United States, as well as throughout the broader diaspora.
In an odd way, then, he wasn't that different from some of the nationalists in Central and Eastern Europe who saw the war as an opportunity for emancipation. What was his association with the left, not necessarily the Marxist left, but people who rejected the war, mm-hmm. People who saw the war particularly in colonial terms? Was that socialist tradition of Debs, did it have much impact on the African-American community?
Did. There was a small but very vibrant and vocal Black socialist community, largely centered in New York City. A. Philip Randolph and Chandler Owen, for example, were editors of a radical socialist newspaper called The Messenger. So there was a small community of African-Americans who were very vocal in their opposition to the war and very critical of W.B. Du Bois and other African-Americans.
I can imagine. I'm sure they were deeply disappointed with Du Bois.
Deeply disappointed. Du Bois at one time was a member of the Socialist Party very briefly. He cast aside his membership of the Socialist Party to support Woodrow Wilson in 1912, which turned out to be a complete disaster. So Du Bois's relationship with the radical left and the Socialist Party in particular during World War One was incredibly vexed. And many of his radical associates, even some of whom were on the NAACP board of directors, did not believe that the United States should have entered the war, and that really strained their relationships with Du Bois. And of course, that manifests itself in even more visceral terms in the aftermath of the war, when it's clear that the United States and African Americans in particular were not going to gain anything from their sacrifice in this horrific conflict.
How high up did Du Bois go in terms of who he talked to, who he mixed with? Did he have conversations with Wilson? Was he well acquainted with that DC world of political insiders?
He was. He didn't have any direct one-on-one conversations with Woodrow Wilson, but the war was an opportunity, as Du Bois saw it, to demonstrate his Americanness, right? This sense of two-ness that he writes about in The Souls of Black Folk, of being Black on the one hand and of being American on the other, right? The warring ideals of being Black and American and the desire to reconcile the two. Du Bois felt, and these were his words, that he felt closer to being an American during the war than at any other time or since in his life. And he threw himself into the American war effort of establishing close relationships with government officials in Washington, D.C., including the Secretary of War, other high-ranking officials in the White House. So his proximity to governmental power was incredibly important, but also very seductive. In terms of why he supported the war and the regrets that he would have in the aftermath of the war as well.
The debate about the war, of course, was complicated at different times. Did he change his mind at all? I mean, how did he respond, for example, to the Russian Revolution and the Russian decision to get out of the war? Was he always pro-war, or did it require the sinking of the Lusitania or something else, the Zimmerman telegram, to convince him that America needed to enter this war?
Yeah, he was really from the start very critical of the war. As I said, he saw it as an imperial war. He saw it really as evidence of the failure of European Enlightenment civilization. He didn't really see the ultimate importance, right, of Black people involving themselves in the war until the United States makes the fateful decision to enter the conflict. And Du Bois then recognizes that it's his duty as an American to support his country. And he does so very controversially, really throughout the duration of America's participation in the war. He writes an editorial entitled Close Ranks in the July 1918 issue of The Crisis, where he encourages African-Americans to set aside their special grievances and support their country. So his views on the war evolve over time, and he ultimately gets swept up into the hyper-patriotism, the hyper-nationalism of the American war effort, and his desire to reconcile these conflicting aspects of Black identity and to be seen as fully American.
Chad, it wasn't just, of course, the left that were opposed to the war in America. There were many quote-unquote American nationalists who were isolationists, who thought that it wasn't the business of America to become involved in the war. Can one make generalizations in this period about the South and the war, the white South, the South that had essentially failed to be reconstructed and was re-architecting itself in the context of Jim Crow? What were the typical, and I know this is probably a hard generalization, but the classic Jim Crow politician, that segment of American political life, what was their take on the war? They weren't always particularly bellicose, were they?
They were. So you have a number of Southern politicians like James Vardaman, a senator from Mississippi, for example, who is opposed to the United States entering the war. For the most part, most white Southerners, particularly poor white Southerners, were very apathetic to the United States entering the war, and especially being drafted into the army. So part of the challenge that the United States faced, part of the challenge that Woodrow Wilson faced, was convincing a very skeptical American public and convincing white Democrats in the South that they needed to rally behind the war effort. He did that through incredible means of propaganda, but also repression through the Alien and Sedition Acts, among other measures. So the efforts to gain support of white Southerners was certainly a challenge. Their support was not given. But it does, I think, speak to the incredible scale, the size scale of the American war effort and the propaganda campaign that went along with it.
You mentioned the Alien and Sedition Act. We've done shows with Adam Hochschild, written a wonderful book, American Midnight, The Great War of Violent Peace and Democracy's Forgotten Crisis, about the authoritarian outcome in America domestically of the war. Do you think that, two questions, Chad, kind of connected. Do you personally think that Du Bois made an error? And secondly, did he recognize in the outcome, in the aftermath of the war, where American democracy wasn't enriched, if anything, it was undermined by an increasingly surveillance state in some ways, dominated by secret police, lots of persecution of leftists, of unionists. So a two-part question. In your view, did he make a mistake? And did he second-guess himself after the war?
So I think it's important to answer that question by taking Du Bois seriously in the context of his times and recognizing that he genuinely hoped, genuinely believed that the war was going to be a turning point, a moment of change and possibility for African-Americans, right? Harkening back to earlier conflicts like the Civil War, when African-Americans gained freedom and citizenship. He believed that World War I was going to be a similar opportunity for Black people. So I think in the moment that Du Bois was in, he made the best decision that he could. And in some ways, it's not a surprising decision that he supported the war. Now, obviously, in hindsight, we can say that Du Bois made a grave error And Du Bois himself, as I write about in my book, recognized that he did, in fact, make an error in supporting the war. One of the major themes of my book is the deep disillusionment that Du Bois wrestled with in the immediate aftermath of the war throughout the entire interwar period, right, about the failure of the war, the failure of American democracy, and ultimately his own personal failure in supporting this conflict, which, as he wrote about extensively in the book that he tried to finish, and in other writings, ultimately made the world even worse, wounded the world in such a deep, profound way that it led to an even more catastrophic world war, two decades later.
Is it possible to argue? I know that historians are always careful about making too many generalizations and connecting sometimes disconnected things. But is it possible to argue that you never would have had FDR and his so-called black cabinet, even if he, in some ways, FDR also disappointed the African-American community without the First World War? I mean, not much, of course, changed in the 20s. Coolidge, Harding, Hoover were all indifferent to the to the African-American community. But stuff changed quite dramatically under FDR.
One of the arguments that I make in my book is that World War I was a critical moment in the broader struggle for Black freedom and equality in the 20th century. The struggles of African Americans for democracy and equal rights, for full civic inclusion, participation in all aspects of the government. World War I laid the foundation for those efforts as they evolved throughout the 1920s and into the 1930s. So I think it is fair to say that you wouldn't have had the type of activism, through an organization like the NAACP, which grew extensively in the aftermath of World War I, which allowed for opportunities to lobby, to make inroads into the federal government and ultimately into the Roosevelt administration. That would not have occurred without World War I.
What about Du Bois's attitude to America? How did that change? You mentioned that he died in Africa. Did it make him more of an Africanist, this whole experience, ultimately?
Du Bois has a very long history, relationship with Africa and Pan-Africanism specifically. He is an attendee at the first Pan-African Congress of the 20th century.
So he was close. Was he close to Marcus Garvey?
He was a deep rival of Marcus Garvey. Right. I explore their relationship in my book. Du Bois, to put it mildly, was not a fan of Marcus Garvey. They ended up having an incredibly vicious feud, became very personal, but it was also over differing visions of Pan-Africanism and who was best suited to speak on the behalf of peoples of African descent. So Du Bois's relationship to Pan-Africanism, another important theme that I explore in the book, The Black Man in the Wounded World, the epic history that he attempted to write, is shaped by his Pan-African convictions and understandings of the Pan-African dimensions of the war specifically, and ultimately his personal connections to Africa deepen throughout the 1920s and 30s. And by the time, he decides to leave the United States in 1961 for Ghana, he's considering Africa to be his final home. And that's ultimately where he is, where he's buried, his final resting place.
How were African Americans treated, the African American soldiers in the First World War in Europe itself? I know in the Second World War, there was a very different kind of experience. There was much, much less intolerance. Did they have the same experience in Europe? Did they have the same association and intimacy with European populations?
So there are roughly 200,000 Black soldiers who served in France during the war. The majority were service of supply troops, SOS troops doing all the dirty, unglamorous work of the war, stevedores, digging ditches, laying railroad tracks, burying dead bodies. But you also have two Black combat divisions who served quite extensively on the front lines. And the experiences of these 200,000 men during their time in France was truly remarkable. It was the first time that many of these men had ever left their homes, much less traveled beyond the United States. And their time in France was revelatory, exposed them to a new world, a new set of possibilities in terms of race relations, the moments of friendship, fraternity, sexual relations with French women. All these really demonstrated that the color line as it existed in the United States, you know, was not necessarily the norm, that there were other possibilities that existed. And as a result, many of these men come back to the United States, deeply transformed, seeing their lives in a different way, and seeing really the radical possibilities of democracy and their willingness to fight for it in the United States after the war as well.
Chad, you mentioned Du Bois's rivalry intellectually and personally with Marcus Garvey and also with Booker T. Would it be fair to say that that the most similar figure to him later in African American history is Martin Luther King, a complicated centrist, or is that oversimplistic?
I think there's certainly some very important similarities between W.B. Du Bois and Martin Luther King Jr. And one of those is Du Bois's peace activism. One of the trajectories of my book is charting how Du Bois evolves from supporting World War I, encouraging African Americans to close ranks, to support their country. By the 1950s, he's at the forefront of the international peace movement and is being persecuted by the federal government for his anti-war beliefs. They even try to put him in jail in 1951. He's 83 years old and facing years of imprisonment for his alleged association with the Soviet Union, simply for advocating for global peace. Similar experience that Martin Luther King Jr. Has by the end of his life, when he comes out against the Vietnam War, where he is considered persona non grata by Lyndon Johnson and many other people in the country, tracing the evolution of Du Bois's radicalism, particularly as it relates to peace, I think offers an important insight and glimpse into Martin Luther King Jr.'s radicalism as well. And of course, Martin Luther King Jr. Deeply revered E.B. Du Bois, both intellectually, but also in terms of his political convictions and commitments as well.
And then, of course, I guess Malcolm X would be the Garvey, the foil. Earlier today, we did a show with Andrew Krivak, a novelist. He's just written a book, Like the Appearance of Horses, a really interesting book about different wars in American history, World War I, World War II, and Vietnam. One of the ironies, it seems to me, of African-American history is, as you know, that African-Americans struggled to be represented in the First World War. And today they're overrepresented. What do you think Du Bois would make of an American army top heavy, if you like, with African Americans in Vietnam, in Afghanistan, in Iraq?
Yeah, it's really an important part of Du Bois's intellectual legacy and historical writings that I think historians have not fully appreciated. Something that I try and emphasize in my book is that Du Bois had a deep appreciation for the Black military experience and the Black military tradition. But he also recognized it as representing one of the fundamental tension that African-Americans faced, that African-Americans continue to face today. What does it mean to fight for a country that is not willing to fight for you? What does it mean to be loyal to a country that does not respect your basic human rights, much less your citizenship rights?
Or even your humanity.
Or your very humanity, absolutely. And this is something that African Americans continue to wrestle with today. The military has served as a really important site of opportunity for African Americans in terms of economic advancement, in terms of professional advancement. It's a very important part of the larger story of Black people in this country. And I think Du Bois would recognize that, but he would also recognize the fundamental tensions that continue to exist in the United States military, and how it continues to speak to the ongoing challenges that Black people face of being recognized as full Americans in this country.
Chad, final question, and just did a show also earlier today with Elliot Ackerman, actually a former American soldier who has a new book out, Halcyon. It's a novel which imagines the science of resurrection. And he talked about resurrecting great American figures from the past and realizing how complicated and perhaps compromised they were. If we could resurrect Du Bois today in 2024, how would he, do you think, what would he think of America? And perhaps even more importantly, what would we think of him?
Well, as I try and lay out in my book, Du Bois was an incredibly complex individual. He was brilliant. He was unparalleled in terms of his achievements, but he was also deeply human. He was deeply flawed in many ways. One of the ways that he was flawed was his support for World War I, you know, which he ultimately sees as a failure and leaving a very tragic legacy on the world, but also on him himself. So I think we would view Du Bois, we should view Du Bois as an individual who was very complex, multi-layered. And I think if Du Bois was alive today, he would continue to be at the forefront of all of the issues facing Black people, as well as oppressed peoples throughout the world, whether that's war, whether that's poverty, whether that's the continued failures of democracy on multiple levels, the attacks on education and the teaching of history. I could go on and on. Du Bois would be at the forefront of all of those issues, and he would be pushing us to be uncompromising in our commitment to fighting for full justice and equality for all oppressed peoples.
I think one thing we could say for sure, Chad, is if we could resurrect Du Bois, he would thank you for finishing his book that he never got to write.
Well, I would certainly hope that he would be thankful. Du Bois was a pretty harsh critic, so who knows what he might say about my book. But hopefully I did justice to him and the story that he wanted to tell in trying to write the history of the war.